Welcome back, everyone, to FinTech Mavericks. I'm your host, Nicole Casperson.
And I'm Drew Glover.
Drew, I've been thinking. Every week, our listeners hear epic playbooks from founders and operators, but how do we make those lessons actionable?
As we both know, tactics are only as good as the tools you plug them into. Wait a minute. What if we hand them the same platform that keeps Fiat's back office humming?
You mean Brex?
Exactly. Let's give the Mavericks a head start, a special offer, Perks the Works, so they can spin smarter and move faster, just like the guests on the show.
I love that. All right, listeners, we've partnered up with our friends at Brex to bring you something very special.
Yeah, this one's legit. You can get up to $750 in Brex travel credit or $450 cash back just for signing up.
And if you're a remote company, your perks get even better. 100,000 bonus points when you deposit $250K into your Brex business account. Then another 25,000 points when you spend $10K on your Brex card.
And on top of the points, you're getting some serious extras. $5,000 in AWS credits, $2,500 in OpenAI credits, access to Brex Capital Solutions, not to mention personalized white glove onboarding to help you hit the ground running.
Want to learn more? Head to brex.com/fintechmavericks and take advantage of the Fintech Mavericks bump as you catapult your business with Brex.
Learn from the best.
Run on the best.
Spin smarter.
And move faster.
That's Brex.
That's Brex. Today's guest is Laura Bach, partner at QED Investors, one of the most active and influential fintech-focused VC firms. She brings a unique lens to venture, a background in biophysics, a consulting career that spanned global financial institutions, and a data-informed approach to betting on what's next. We love to see it. Laura, welcome to FinTech Mavericks.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yeah. All right. To dive in, you started in a lab, not a boardroom. How did your background in biophysics shape the investor that you are today?
Yeah. So when I went to college, I was definitely a bit of a science nerd. I studied chemistry, biology, physics, and spent a lot of time in a lab. I soon realized I hated pipetting and I was not going to be patient enough for an academic life. But I do think that a lot of the scientific mindset has stuck with me. And I think you can apply the scientific method in a sense to investing, right? You observe, you make it a hypothesis, you try to gather data, analyze the results, make a decision. So I think that actually has served me pretty well, even in this different seat.
I think you're our first biophysicist on the show ever. So that's new for us. But I agree. I feel like journalism is quite similar, right? Like at the end of the day, we're all just kind of like testing hypothesis and thesis and then like finding out what the data tells us and then reporting what comes back, right?
And you know, I would also just jump in there and say like running Fiat Ventures, like as a venture capitalist, there are many things that I'm great at and there's other things that I'm not that great at. And I feel like all VCs have something they're a superpower at and then other things that are kind of learned. Like the things that were not learned for me was just like, I know I can make friends with a lot of people. The things that are learned are some of these things that, you know, Laura was a nerd about in college that now she can come in and really bring into the VC space. Like I've worked with Laura for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now. And I have constantly leaned on Laura to give me insights about fintech businesses in a scientific way that I generally, it doesn't come natural to me. And so it's a huge superpower. And as we all know in the VC space, like underwriting, understanding business models, understanding how businesses works and the nuances of them, but not just thinking about it today, but thinking about it from like a historical standpoint and bringing it back together and kind of being a data scientist when it comes to thinking about businesses and founders is really important. I am curious, Laura, like the biophysics piece came natural to you from a VC perspective, but what are some of the other pieces of the VC world that you kind of had to learn to get really good at that didn't come natural because you didn't have a background in that side of the business?
Drew, we might be like opposites. I feel like for me, the networking piece of venture is obviously it's like a private investments, which means you can't just find the data anywhere. You have to talk to people, you have to network, you have to hustle. So I think that part was the part that was like the steep learning curve. And it also takes time to like get into the the flow of things in the tech community. I wasn't coming from tech. My first job was as a consultant. So that was in bank world, insurance carrier world, which is just a totally different space.
Wow. So, I mean, you have called venture capital one giant experiment. Are there any fun experiments that you're running right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you think about like any startup, it's continuous experimentation, right? It's like what works, what doesn't, adjust, repeat. And so at QED, we have, I don't know, it's like 100, maybe almost 200 different startups that we've invested in. And so we're really lucky. We get to like watch and hopefully once in a while jump in and give some advice on a bunch of parallel experiments. And so I think that's been like really interesting. I think like the best companies are the ones that compound learnings the quickest with these experiments. They don't ignore negative data the same way they don't ignore positive data. And they actually, you know, are pretty unbiased when it comes to listening to the market. And I think like within QED itself, we are testing our own strategy, right? So like what stage is best because we're a multi-stage fund, what check size, how should we follow on, what type of company should we invest in? And like, it's definitely long time horizon. So it takes time to collect the data, but you can parallelize some of those learnings, which is nice.
Is there any new data that you've uncovered recently that has validated like a gut instinct that you had about fintech and the industry?
I think on a company by company basis, like there's definitely things that I've learned where going in, I wasn't sure of something, but you get to see it kind of come true over time as they go to market, test their product with new customers. So definitely a bunch of those.
I know like one thing, and you know, I probably invest a little bit earlier than QED. I'm typically pre-seed and seed, but a large percentage of the founders and companies that I back, when they actually hit product market fit, a lot of times it's not the product that I invested in. Obviously I had to invest in it from like a team perspective. I'm curious, as you're, you know, you kind of bringing together both data as well as just like gut of like, is this founder the founder to do it? How do you kind of weigh those? I feel like as I've spoken to many VCs over the years, like they weigh them differently based on just how they approach the space, but what's the juggling act for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a combo, and maybe my weightings have changed over the years since I started the job 7 years ago. And I think at that point, you don't really have a tuned gut instinct, or at least I didn't. And so I was probably leaning, you know, a little bit more on the data. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, having worked with dozens of founders and teams, I think that I trust the gut instinct a little bit more these days, but I think you really have to have both, right? Like You have to know that the economics of a company work, that they're seeing traction, that the market's big enough. But some of those intangibles that take time to calibrate, either as an investor or having operated in startups over the years, I think are equally as important, like team camaraderie or the founder's mindset, or are customers actually really in love with the product, or do they just, you know, say, oh, it's okay, I need something. So I think over time, the balance for me has shifted a bit.
Yeah. And sorry, we're just going to jump around here because obviously I have so much, I'm just in this in general. And sorry, when I speak to Laura, I'm just like, I'm treating it as an education opportunity for me, but also, So just rolling with it, there's a million trends going on in the space right now. Obviously, AI is playing a huge role of what's going on. I struggle with the idea of like where venture is headed. Saying that their venture won't exist anymore, but I do think the model potentially might shift. And I think we spoke about this in New York maybe like a couple months ago, Laura. But, you know, one, they're probably will be a ton of really great founders that aren't looking to build multi-billion-dollar businesses anymore, but might just be looking to build like smaller businesses in general. And also, I think because of the way companies scale, we might not be getting, you know, 10 different rounds of funding anymore. It might be 3-4, like maybe 2 or 3 rounds of funding, and maybe that's all they need to get the liquidity event. But I'm curious, as you look at the future of venture and with all the movement we've seen over the last year and a half here, 18 months, where do you think venture is headed? Do you think the model is going to shift or stay the same?
I mean, I think it's constantly shifting, right?
Yeah.
Venture, I don't know the exact data, but it like doubled or tripled over a 10-year run-up. And I think now we're in a little bit of a contraction.
Big time. It's
will AI save everyone or not is definitely like one question. But no, I do think that like different types of firms need to just position themselves to compete for the best deals. And so there are some that are being caught in between some of these different models that are working. I mean, obviously at QED, we think a specialist model can lead to better diligence, better, you know, ability to help companies. But I also think, you know, having a lot of scale and a large platform and a lot of connections is like another model that's working really well.
Totally. And QED, you guys add so much more than capital, which I think has been a huge important point of your guys' success generally in being able to win deals. Obviously, there's a lot of really large firms out there that really just focus on just like, we are capital and that's it. Like, do you think that, and obviously you're biased here, but the importance of capital plus something else to be able to be that smart money on the cap table, how important has that been for you and the QED team, do you think, over the last years to win deals?
I mean, I think you'd have to ask founders to know how important it actually is.
Yeah,
but I think from our perspective, one of the biggest gates on whether or not you win a deal, since for most companies that we give term sheets to, they're getting multiple term sheets. And I think it really is the founder reference of the partner and of the firm that makes the difference. And I think there are multiple aspects to it. It's, you know, what does the person like to work with, but it's also probably value add. And I think that can vary a lot in what it looks like firm to firm.
I mean, you have compared raising capital to writing a novel one chapter at a time. And I've written a book, but I have never raised capital. So maybe I'm like halfway there. All right. What makes a founder's story then just impossible to put down and like unforgettable?
Yeah. And I have to give a shout out to one of my mentors from QED, Frank Rotman, for that analogy.
Yeah.
He likes to use that for like the alphabet soup of fundraising, essentially. You know, when Nicole, when you wrote your book, you probably had a publisher that bought it either when it was complete or before you wrote it and said, yes, I want this whole thing. Obviously with startups, it's much more piecemeal than that, right? You have almost like a seed chapter, a series A chapter. Mm. And I think that can lead to weird incentives. You know, you have to, founders today feel like they have to build excitement going into a fundraise as opposed to just build what will be the greatest business over, you know, the long run. But yeah, in terms of what makes the story great, I think, clear urgency. So like, why should this business be built now? I think a deep founder market connection, founder understanding the market better than anyone, as well as, you know, tangible traction and a glimpse into what the future could look like. That's really exciting. I think those are all, I don't know about a story, but definitely a company.
I mean, I think so. Is there someone, right? I mean, and is there anyone or a few or someone that just stands out to you right now that's like doing this particularly well?
In terms of companies?
Yeah. And founders.
I mean, we have a lot of founders in our portfolio that do this really well. I think, I mean, just a recent investment. So we doubled down on a company called Payably in the payments infrastructure space. Really talented team looking to build pay in and payout infrastructure for any software company. The idea is any software company should be a payments company. And I think they've done a really great job of both painting the picture of why this could be massive and could transform the way payments are added to companies, as well as, you know, understand the day-to-day blocking and tackling and how to win on the field moment to moment. And kind of have that come through in their story. So I say they're doing it really well.
Oh, okay. Where are they doing it well? Is it like, are they on LinkedIn? What are they, creating content? Like, how are you seeing kind of the story play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're doing it well with their team, with their customers. Mm. I think they're doing it well in conferences that are important for the verticals that they're targeting. And then obviously, like, you know, have raised more capital. They raised an A and then they raised a Series B in less than 12 months. That's fairly rare. So I'd say that they're setting themselves up well for success.
Yeah. In terms of, I think it's important because you guys invested in Payably and then you doubled down on Payably. And I'm curious, as you guys have capital to deploy, how do you think through that first check versus reserves and like continuing to double down, knowing that like the later you invest, the more expensive the capital you investing is, but your conviction in that process?
We try to invest at the earliest stage that we have conviction. I think that at that point, you know, we like to be full conviction investors, take, you know, 10, 15% of a company, join the board, try to be hands-on. But at the same time in the US, we talk a lot about the clone wars in fintech, which is that for any category that's really exciting, you'll see, you know, 3, 5, 12 companies going after the exact same thing.
Yep.
And so it can be difficult. I mean, it seems very difficult pre-seed, but even at seed to figure out who's breaking out and who you want to back. And as, you know, a fintech specialist, like we don't want to ever back competitors if we can avoid it. So occasionally, you know, we'll wait a bit to do that full conviction check. In terms of reserves, I think our fund strategy, if I'm not, probably isn't so different from most folks, but we tend to reserve not quite, but almost one-to-one first check follow on. But with that follow on, we're trying to slope it as much as we possibly can. And what that means is the goal for us is getting 50% of the dollars of the fund into our top quarter logos, which is hard to tell because you're figuring it out in real time. But that's the goal. And so for a company like Payably, where you see breakout growth and massive potential, it doesn't feel painful to pay a markup price, given you think that the exit value could be really strong. And you have that inside track on some of the progress that might not be visible to the world yet.
Yeah, no. So that's really interesting. I think just for a lot of our listeners, just I think it also just goes back to how you guys are underwriting risk as well. If you're open to it, we'd love for you to share a little bit more about how you think about risk in that situation of saying, great, although we already have whatever 10, 15% of this business, we're going to go, you know, spend more money on this, maybe get a little bit more exposure instead of keeping that money for, you know, 1 to 2 additional investments in other companies at the Series A stage that you normally invest. But in your brain as a firm, as an investor, that's a decision you have to make. And so how are you underwriting that from a risk perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing that we think about is when you've been inside a company for a year, 2 years, just the risk profile and your visibility is just very different. And so I think that's why we are, more excited to do that follow-on check into something that we feel close with, than to save that capital to grab one or two more logos. I think you really can't compete with the data and the intelligence that you have from watching the video tape unfolding from like almost within the locker room. We try to do it with net new investments, you know, follow companies over time, talk to their customers, talk to their investors, but you're like not in the room in the same way.
That's right. And you guys are always getting board seats. Is that mandatory for y'all with investments?
No, not mandatory. Okay. I think just given, you know, the ownerships that we're sometimes going after, it tends to happen more often than not, but not necessary.
I mean, what is your advice to founders who are maybe great at building, but struggle with the pitch, especially considering everything that you just said? It's really competitive these days in fintech land, yet also some of our greatest financial problems seemingly are still existing. How can founders just get better at communicating their value to someone like yourself?
Yeah, I think like my main advice, especially the founders that don't like pitching, is to not try to be slick, not try to be salesy. Just be clear, you know, clearly spell out the pain point. You know, if you can bring in user, vivid kind of user customer stories to make the investor understand the pain point, like that's very powerful. And then, you know, the other thing I would say is like try to make it conversational. Investors learn better, or at least I do, through asking questions and just absorb more through a dialogue than like a 15-minute monologue. And then I would say adjust to the audience, right? Like we're fintech specialists. You can skip the why the mortgage market's really big and just talk about like why what you're doing is new, why it's better than what's been done before. So tailoring to that audience, I think is key as well.
Just to build on that, so I think from a pitch standpoint, it's one thing. I would also note that in this market shift that we're in right now, building around profit, sustainability, like what kind of advice would you give to founders in terms of like talking through that of versus the, hey, we're going to grow by any means necessary versus this new market of we want to grow sustainably, but also at the pace that it's required as a startup?
Yeah, I think it's really tricky to like have those conversations. They're so unique to every single startup and their situation and availability of capital, what their underlying economics look like. I mean, at the earliest stages, like you need to see growth. Venture dollars are meant for hyperscale. And so I think that you need to see growth. And so this is more of a question when you start reaching growth capital, how you tune between profitability and growth. And I just think there are a lot of different variables at play there.
Like what?
How available capital is definitely one. Whether the growth that you have, you know, is unit profitable. I think doesn't matter how available capital is. Well, maybe for some businesses, you could grow in a unit negative way. We wouldn't recommend it for most of the businesses that we tend to invest in. But a case could be made. What else? What the competition looks like, whether it's like a winner take all market dynamic where you need to kind of race to get ahead. Those are some of the ones I can think of.
And how do you balance some of the, I guess, founder vision in these stages? Right? Because I know that this is when you're kind of moving into growth mode. This is when that part can get a little muddy, right? There's more cooks in the kitchen. Everyone's, you know, ultimately after the same goal. But yeah, how do you just balance that founder vision with the investor discipline when advising on this like growth stage mode?
I mean, I think ultimately the founder should be setting the vision. Like where we've made mistakes is where we hear a pitch and we're kind of superimposing our vision on top of what they've said. And like, that does not work. So I think that like definitely the founder needs to drive the company's direction, set big goals, have the market intelligence and insight, inspire the team. So I think that's really critical. I think when it comes to the founder balancing their vision versus discipline, I think that's really, really essential. Because if they're, you know, two in the clouds, they could become disconnected from reality. So they have to be disciplined. They have to get, you know, hands-on, get into details, drive results, measure things, say no to running too many experiments at once. So I think getting the balance between a founder's vision and a founder discipline, like that's where I see the tension and importance.
It's fun to play with tension.
Yeah, I agree. I want to jump a little bit more into like trends that are going on in the space right now. And I
was thinking the same.
Yes. From like a topical standpoint, you know, or I say foundational standpoint, one of the biggest shifts that we've seen over the last couple of years is, you know, direct to consumer fintech has taken a big hit, and it's really been B2B and B2B2C and even like B2B2B. Like, there's all these different, you know, how do we embed fintech into the existing infrastructure of all commerce? But I'm curious, like, what are some trends that you're just like generally excited about?
It's funny, Drew. I was talking to someone. We had a team offsite last week, and we were talking about direct to consumer fintech. And I think it's, I hope it comes back.
Me too.
I think it's not feeling the love that it should. And I think some of it is that maybe the market got over eager. We launched like several hundred neobanks, it seems like.
Yeah.
but the infrastructure has gotten a lot better, right? So embedded fintech has gotten better, layering on new types of products, data aggregation, companies that we know, Drew, like Spinwheel, that can do like read, write, make payments, get nitty gritty details that are hard to get, real time balances on liabilities. Like, all of these things could unlock, I think, a more interesting generation of direct-to-consumer fintech companies that, I mean, plus AI, they could do things that the prior generation could not. And so I'm excited for more differentiated offerings on that side. And I think that hopefully the category gets some more love in the coming years.
Do you have any hot takes on like what a, like what could make consumer fintech have its proper comeback? Although I guess people would think like the Chime IPO is considered a comeback of sorts, but I don't know. Is that a comeback? That's already like that was a thing. That was, Drew said it. That was like, that happened in the past. They're now a success off of what they did in the past, but it doesn't necessarily apply to today's market, yeah. Right?
It was success of another market. And so I don't think another neobank can do what Chime did, but I mean, it's a great question because, you know, in the direct-to-consumer fintech space, there are all these promises that have been made in products that have actually just, they didn't have their time in the sun because they were born out of a market where it was around massive rounds and they were trying to scale with the kind of a warped model. I'm seeing, and Laura, I'm curious to get your thoughts here. I'm seeing a lot of new direct-to-consumer companies pop up right now. That are in the earliest stages that actually have similar promises to what people were trying to do 4 or 5 years ago, but now they're doing it with a really seasoned founder, someone not just trying to like get a quick liquidity event and get a big round. And also they're really good business managers. And so I feel like they might have a better shot, but I'm curious to get your general thoughts on that.
What would make direct to consumer fintech come back would be differentiation. Like, I think Chime paved the way in like a very exciting way, but I think products need to differentiate. I think they can do it in a couple ways. Like, Drew, you're right, like some of the, you know, personal financial management apps, they've been around for a long time. As a fintech investor, I have a folder with like hundreds of these apps that I've downloaded and I've tried, and some of them are doing very similar things, but they just do them way better now than they did 5 years ago. Right. Mm-hmm. The data aggregation works. The data categorization works better. Like, there are small things that just make the experience much better. But I think the next thing that maybe is over talked about, but I still think is exciting, is like what AI could do here with, you know, how people manage their money. I think the truth is most people don't want to open up five different apps, toggle between and investment app, a checking app, and try to figure out how to manage things. They would much rather just write in their goals, check it every once in a while, put it on autopilot, and know that, you know, their money is being optimized and they're doing all the right things. And so that's what I'm really excited about, is when a fintech company can automate the next best action for a consumer. I think that will be a huge change, and that would be a fintech app that deserves to go viral.
Yes, Laura, you're speaking my language. I'm telling you, Laura, I have said those exact words somewhere. Somewhere in a podcast in the ether of somewhere in our lives. I covered wealth management fintech before I started Fintech as Femme at Investment News, and this was like, and this is, you know, 5 years ago. This is still the conversation that we're having today, is, and this is like my forever like pen just constantly writing the same narrative because we haven't changed it yet, right? Which is why have we not figured out how to enable a consumer to take their next best action, right? And then it's been interesting in consumer finance in terms of like, well, there were the very like identity focused neobanks, and that got a little wonky and strange, right? There's just neobanks just like creating the experience of a branch on a phone, totally necessary. That needed to happen, right? This like next evolution of, cool, we have the AI, we have the large digital footprint. How are we actually enabling, right, the cohesive talking of all of these points to tell someone, this is the thing you need to do next, right, to reach this goal? And I think that there's a lot of players in the space that are like talking about doing that, but I have not seen it. If someone would like to tell me, I would love that app. I, for one, am not obsessed with looking at everything all the time myself. I'm like, I'm on the internet enough. I don't need to do it with my finances as well. Can I? Yeah. Is there an app that is able to do that? And I think you're right. That is the app that should go viral. But it's like, what is the missing link to enable that, right? Is it lifestyle? Is it the right branding? Is it, you know, and is it the right story, the right company to even come up and exist? So whoever's working on that, feel free to hit Laura up.
Apparently. Well, for sure.
I am curious, Laura, though, because I do feel like technology just generally isn't a moat anymore. Like me and my wife, we do our finances through a custom GPT that we created just by putting all of our information in there. You know, like I believe that data, and I believe that data and distribution are like two of the last moats if you just have really great proprietary data. But in this AI wrapper world that we live in right now, like as an investor, how do you get conviction around a product that doesn't necessarily have a huge technical moat, and it really just comes down to their ability to scale, or as we just called it, go viral?
Yeah, it's funny, Drew, I have the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, tried to code that up in ChatGPT.
Of course.
I don't think everyone will do that. I mean, maybe they will.
Apparently I need to do that.
I think it's tricky. I think that it's something we talk about a lot. But it's where I go back to that product velocity. You know, teams that are really good, and maybe Chime is a good example of this, like they were faster than other folks at iterating the user experience, adding on features, reacting to customer needs. I think that will still exist. And I think that those types of things build brand and are valuable, even if there's not like a core technology moat.
Truth. But it also goes back to me to think that I think a lot of founders and a lot of like the early teams, it's less about how do we get the absolute best dev team. It's about how do we get the best growth minds that can tinker away and become these like growth scientists into like ensuring scale.
100%. I think that's still true for direct-to-consumer fintech. Like, what do we look for? I mean, we definitely look for someone that has incredible products taste, but more than that, it's, are you maniacal about customer acquisition, unit economics, marketing, brand, messaging? Yeah. And I think like that's going to be true for a long time.
Totally.
Yeah, like we
taste,
have to find
taste the, is a through point. Taste. Yeah.
Taste, that's the take, right? It's like taste is the one thing that AI can't really replicate. Right, is like a human or a founder's right ability to create the cool factor, right? Which is, I think, what we're missing, right? Is basically taking all the pieces of the things that we've said and like it being able to come together, right? No one has kind of nailed that cohesive piece of consumer fintech. Thus, this conversation continues on, right? Like, thus, we don't know who is going to create that moment. Are there, outside of consumer fintech, are there other verticals where you are particularly excited about? Is it anything that we might not expect?
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe one that you might not expect, insurance infrastructure. I feel like
cool factor.
Right, if you look at insurance, huge profit pools, totally under-digitized. Like VC dollars just like have not been attracted to insurtech, and when they have, I think a lot of people would say first gen insurtech didn't fully deliver. But if you talk to insurance carriers, there's still a huge opportunity, right? Huge. Like, it's confused, like distribution's confusing for customers. It's through brokers. Carriers are struggling with compressing margins, and there is a huge need for better tooling across the board. And this is one where there are a lot of humans in the loop doing manual things that presumably could be automated to some degree. And so I think when you think about claims automation, when you think about underwriting, distribution, those are all areas that we're watching closely, along with many others, to see, like, does AI change something significantly in this category in a way that we should be interested in?
Do you think, when it comes to something like insurance, do you think that it is on a fintech company, I guess particularly if they're consumer facing or what have you, but on them to help with that educational element of it? I have a whole section of, like, my book on insurance and how it needs that fintech facelift, if you will. But yeah, what's your like take on that? Should a fintech company be having that ownership of educating in terms of, like, what could be done better in X industry, in this case, something as misunderstood as insurance?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely could play a role. I think that depends on the product. I personally don't believe, like, brokers are going to be disintermediated and disappear anytime soon. Same with financial advisors. But I think that technology could definitely help with the education. I think technology could change some of the product constructs here to make them more transparent, more easy to understand, and especially make the pricing clearer. So, I mean, I see that in a lot of the insurtech companies that we've seen.
And at least this is what I've seen, but the majority of that within insurance, those are B2B opportunities. Is that your general consensus? Like, how do I empower a financial advisor or a broker or a insurance agency to better deliver services based on data, based on a number of different things? Are you seeing, like, B2B model, B2C models also an opportunity, like the worlds of, like, the Lemonades of the world and, like, the big boom of direct to consumer life insurance, stuff like that?
I think we see opportunity on both sides. I think that on direct to consumer, we believe that there has to be, like, a real gap in the market, because insurance carriers, you know, they actually operate fairly efficiently. They have a lot of money to spend.
They do.
If you look around at commercials, like, they are everywhere. But in certain areas, I mean, we're investors in Kin, very happy investors in Kin. They do home insurance.
Yep.
They help folks that have houses in areas that are difficult to insure through their kind of superior underwriting model. That helps them, you know, not take on too much risk, but also serve folks that other carriers don't want to serve. So I think, like, that is a huge opportunity that we're excited about on the direct side. But it probably also is true that a lot of what I'm talking about and what we're looking at is more B2B, whether that's tools for brokers on the distribution side, or whether that's tools for carriers for underwriting, for claims automation, for policy admin.
Is there, like, a category? And maybe it's insurance, but is there a category that, like, if a founder were to pitch you after we hung up on this podcast and you'd just be, like, so excited to hear about, is there one that for right now you probably maybe alternate your obsessions, right? Just like you kind of alternate what kind of music you're listening to or something. Is that how it's like for you?
Yeah, a little bit. We definitely have maybe like a half dozen pet themes, theses, areas that we're looking at any given time. I'd say a lot of mine right now over the past couple months have been in, like, business back office. So think, like, CFO stack. How can you help businesses do payables, receivables more easily? How do you help with accounting, tax, even treasury management? I'm pretty excited about companies that help small businesses and mid-market businesses become more on par with what like corporate counterparts can do. Mm-hmm. Just kind of like democratization of business tools accessible only for the largest companies.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's something to be said for like, and a lot of VCs I think right now are very much looking at unsexy spaces that have historically been more on like the services side, but there's, because of AI, there's an opportunity to turn them into like fully technology enabled businesses. I think accounting, that whole space, very obvious. You get a client for, someone signs up to you as with an accountant, they're going to stay with you for 5 years. How do we turn that 20% margin into an 89 or 90% margin? Or do you find yourself outside of just like accounting and that kind of business back office space, just like generally looking for these spaces that historically weren't able to be optimized beyond kind of just like a pure services offer that now can be?
Yeah, 100%. I think like VCs across the market are rethinking what thing was uninvestable 3-5 years ago, where they might have like a graveyard of companies that didn't work because it was tech enabled services. And guess what? The tech only got to 60% gross margin and they had a huge R&D budget attached to this kind of, you know, sub optimized services business with, okay, like if it's built AI enabled, AI centric from the start, like, will it be different? It seems like for certain categories, like companies are ripping, and the answer is definitely.
Yes.
But we're trying to see for some of these financially oriented horizontal categories like accounting, like, or financial advisors, wealth management, like, will that be true?
I like it. These are all very good bits. See, now any founders that are listening to this know exactly what to pitch Laura. I love it. And we're about to move into our rapid fire questions, but I am curious, what is maybe the piece of fintech that you still find wildly undervalued? Is it like one of the categories we've just talked about? Is it something we haven't yet?
Direct to consumer fintech is definitely
still undervalued.
In the doghouse.
Still in the doghouse.
I think, well, we'll see. Maybe things are changing. Nothing like immediately pops to mind. I mean, I think things ebb and flow so much. Like, what's in style, what's out of style, what multiples are assigned to things.
Then in that ebb and flow, with the way that like the trend line happens, is there anything that you always kind of hold on to? Like, is there, I don't know, like a core something that always like keeps you grounded when things kind of push and pull you to look at the shiny new object, which in fintech we're so good at. We love a shiny new object.
That's totally true. I mean, I think one of the issues that happened in 2021, 2022 was there was a flood of money into fintech, from all different types of firms. And fintech revenue models are different and can be wildly different than software revenue models. And I think venture investors, downstream capital, sometimes put the same multiples on businesses that had very different gross margin profiles. And so when we think as a team and we're trying to stay like anchored a bit, we try to look at gross profit, apply multiples there. It's a little bit more normalized. And can hopefully keep you from suffering a lot of multiple compression as the company grows and gets closer to an exit.
Amazing. All right. Well, we are at our last few minutes here. So I'm going to get us into, we're going to do 10 rapid fire questions, Laura, which basically just means we're going to ask a question first thing that comes to mind. Sound good?
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's do it. So the first app that you check in the morning?
Calendar.
Ooh, you might be the first person that said that. I think we've gotten Instagram, we've gotten Gmail, we've gotten Slack. Calendar. All right.
When do I have to get out of bed? What's my first meeting?
So, I don't know, especially if you're working from home, it's kind of just like, anyways. Okay. What is a tiny habit that makes you feel 10 times more productive?
I like to try to walk my dog without my phone. Mm-hmm. So, sans phone time, kind of in the morning, first thing. thinking time, reset for the day.
I like that. I like that. One founder trait you always bet on.
Relentlessness.
Okay, great. Phew, I'm glad I have that. Okay, a quote that lives rent-free in your head.
I'm going to say, the quieter you become, the more you're able to hear.
Oh.
And I don't know who said it, but...
I like that.
We're not going to do wrong attributions here. We're just going to enjoy the quote for the quote's sake. Someone check that later. Yeah, we'll find that one. But I love that one. Okay. Most unexpected category you're obsessed with right now.
Accounts receivables and payables automation.
Nice.
I actually do have a fintech in mind for you that I should tell you about if you probably already heard of it. But yeah, I, as a business owner, agreed. Okay.
Well,
Drew,
I'm going to jump over on my side here. Best book you've read this year that's not about business.
To be honest, Drew, I don't think I've read a book about or not about business all year, but I do have a book club meeting in 2 weeks, and I'm supposed to read Long Island Compromise, which is by the woman that wrote Fleischman's in Trouble, which I did not read, but I watched the TV show.
I watched it. I watched the TV show as well. It's pretty irreverent. We'll check back in on that one.
Someone get this girl a TV show she can binge watch in 2 weeks to make up for the book club.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
No, I love that. I love it. Is there a plan? Is there a plan to try to read this book in 2 weeks? No.
Allegedly.
It's okay.
I would.
Yeah,
it's
okay, Audible, Laura, that's your plan on 1.0 or 2x speed.
Yeah, 2x speed exactly. And like download it really fast. It's okay, Laura. I don't think I've read a book in its entirety since I wrote mine, and I'm still trying to figure out what's that about.
I love that.
Most underrated skill for early stage founders.
Knowing when to say I don't know.
Mm. Good.
Or
I
like
love
comfort
that.
With not knowing everything.
There it is.
Or what song on your playlist do you love listening to the most when you're in like full deal mode, just locked in?
I'm a like big Fleetwood Mac fan. My mom got me hooked on Fleetwood Mac. I went to see Stevie Nicks a couple years ago. So I'm going to go that.
Also, Stevie Nicks is a vibe.
This job has destroyed my Spotify minutes, though, because we're always in meetings.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Very sad.
Well, yeah, we were just on with Ryan Breslow, and he's like, I have a whole Spotify playlist. He was like multiple playlists. So I guess he can make up for that. Like the way that he just had all of these playlists. And now Laura's like, when do we have time for music? when do I listen to music ever? I'm in meetings all day. But no, I oddly find music very like as much as like a productivity thing. The loop-de-loop keeps me like, type it and go in. But anyways, Fleetwood Mac.
This is maybe not for the podcast, but my sister told me yesterday that there's a great Spotify playlist called Misogyny But It Slams, which might be worth checking out.
I don't know. That's actually quite funny.
If you start searching for stuff on Spotify, the amount of random podcasts that exist that fit your exact mood will surprise you.
Yeah, I like one playlist that's like songs I'll play for my kids so they know I was cool.
I mean, send that one to me. I'm hitting that age with my little one. Very last one. Finish the sentence. The best founders always
are magnets for money, talent, customers, everything.
Love that. 100% agree. 100% agree. Incredible.
Relentless magnet. I swear there was another one earlier, but I've been a magnet for everything. All right. I'm going to make sure I embody all of these things. Okay. Laura, thank you so much for bringing so much insight and intention to the world of fintech investing. And thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Yes. And appreciate you so much.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, all right.